Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Winning the hearts of millions of fans in the 80s as the lead singer of British band Kajagoogoo, British singer-songwriter Limahl enjoyed the instant celebrity of hitting the top of the charts with his debut single Too Shy, which was followed by two more top 20 hits, Ooh To Be Ah and Hang On Now. Limahl went solo and soon re-emerged in the charts again with his first solo single Only For Love. That was quickly followed by the Giorgio Moroder-produced worldwide smash Never Ending Story, theme song from the hit film of the same name. In addition, Never Ending Story and Too Shy were featured on hit TV shows Black Mirror, American Horror Story, and Stranger Things. He has also appeared on the ITV show I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. He remains very active, continuing to perform live throughout Europe, recently headlining Pride in Cologne. He performed and co-hosted the Sense Charity Gala at London's Westminster Church Hall with the Princess Royal in attendance, raising over £100,000. He also performed at a charity auction for the Terence Higgins Trust, which also raised over £100,000. In Madrid, he recently performed at the world premiere of a new stage musical adaptation of the never-ending story, La Historia Interminable, now playing in Barcelona. In 2025, he releases his festive season single, One Wish for Christmas. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Limahl.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Well, hi, Barrett. I'm in Hertfordshire, which is the first county north of London. So I'm 17 minutes by train into central London, and I'm good. No, I'm doing a lot of Pilates at the moment, and it's amazing because I've never done it. I'm not as young as I used to be, and I joined a new gym that had all these classes included, and one day I just thought, I'll try this. I've heard about this Pilates, and if you're careful, you know, and you don't give yourself an injury, don't push yourself too far, there's something about doing exercise in a group. There's sort of peer pressure, there's a social aspect, it's just more fun, and the teacher's good. I'm loving it, and that's my thing at the moment.
I totally agree with you. I teach spinning classes. I know exactly what you're referring to.
No, the spinning classes, they scare me.
They scare a lot of people, but it depends on the instructor.
Can you convince me otherwise?
I'm a very nice instructor. All the beginners, they just go slowly. But they need to listen to me and go slowly, because normally they don't listen to me and they go fast, and that's when the problems come.
Right. And so spinning is, what is that, a 45-minute class?
Just over 40 minutes, and then we stretch for about 5 to 8 minutes afterwards.
Okay, and it's basically what, cardiovascular?
In my class, we don't just do cycling. I bring in upper body strength, core training, combinations, sometimes dumbbells, so it's a whole body workout.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, maybe I'll give it a go because I do have spinning at mine. And where do you do that, Barrett?
I do it at the local gym near to me.
Okay. Yeah. And where are you? What country are you in?
I'm in South Africa.
Oh, wow. Never Ending Story and Too Shy, both number one there.
Have you been here before?
I came in 84 at the request of EMI Records to promote Never Ending Story. I did some radio, and I think I did a TV show. It's 41 years ago.
Yes.
It's a bit hazy, the memory, but yeah, I was in Joburg and also Cape Town, but of course the climate then was so different, the landscape, the political landscape.
Yes, exactly. Very different. Okay, so now let's dive into your journey. How, where, and what was the inspiration to create the stage name Limahl? How did that come to fruition?
Okay, interesting first question, Barrett. I just thought you had to have a stage name, you know, when I was thinking about getting in the music business. And I remember I was a big fan of ABBA, the Swedish pop group. I remember reading an interview where how they got their name using the letters of the first names of the band members. So Agneta, Benny, Bjorn, and of course Annie Frieda. So I thought that was cool. And I also thought having one name as your stage name, like Sting from The Police, I thought that was cool. I didn't think I could do much with Chris or Christopher, my real name. I started looking at my surname, Hamill, and I flipped the letters around a bit and I sort of went Lamal. And I thought, well, that sounds quite exotic. It's double L at the end, like Mark Hamill from Star Wars. The only other famous Hamill in the world, I think. It's double L at the end, so I sort of read it. Yeah, Lamal. I thought, begins with an L, ends with an L, Lamal. Sounds like a cocktail or possibly something like that. So, yeah, I thought I'd try that. I turned up at the band rehearsal. I'd just joined Kajagoogoo. And we were talking of names. We were throwing names around for the band because when I joined them, Kajagoogoo, they were called Art Nouveau. So I turned up at rehearsal. I'd moved to a town called Leighton Buzzard, about 50 miles north of London, to live close to the band. I was actually sharing a flat with a bass player and his girlfriend. It was all about names, yeah. And I walked into the rehearsal and I said, guys, don't call me Chris anymore, I'm Lamal. And there was this sort of silence. Thankfully, you know, they respected my wishes and thankfully it worked out.
Let's rewind even before then. So at what age, whether you were a child or teenager, did you think, okay, I want to be in this music world? It's a multi-decade journey. And how did that journey progress?
Wow, I can't give you a quick answer to that question. It's very hard to explain. I mean, you hear people who have certain aspirations, whether it's to be an astronaut or work in medicine, and they'll often tell you they felt it at a very early age, in their bones, in their blood, in their DNA, you don't know what it is. I was fascinated with music. And around the age of 10, my mother's friend gave me an old record player that she was throwing out and six singles. And I wish I'd kept it. It was a beautiful 1950s. I think she'd upgraded, you know, she'd got like one of those modern stereograms. This was a portable thing with a lid.
Yes.
And I loved it. And I played these singles to death. And I was fascinated how you could put this arm with a needle onto the black plastic and this incredible sound would come out. And I think I was going dizzy watching the thing go around, you know, the 45s. And I'd read the label. I wanted to know everything about how was it. So it became a kind of obsession. And then I guess that turned into, this is the business I've got to get into because this is fun. This sounds fun. It looks fun. Being creative, I guess, was appealing. So, yeah, probably from the age of 10. And then when I got to like 14, 15 years old, I would go out doing odd jobs. My family didn't have much money. I had two brothers and a sister. You know, you were brought up to work to get any money. I would deliver newspapers, or I was on the bread, delivering bread. Sometimes I would go out doing gardening. And then I would take the money I earned and go down to our local independent record store in Wigan, which is near Manchester, a small town. And I was so excited. I'd walk into that store and the top 20 would be on the wall and look at it thinking, oh, which one shall I buy? Which one shall I buy? And you can't imagine the value of holding that record. And yes, then I would take it to the youth club. I used to go to a local youth club twice a week called the Woodford Street Youth Club. And they had a record player. I sort of became the self-appointed DJ. And I would go in with my new single. And of course, my single collection grew. So, it was just an obsession from, as I say, through those teens And then eventually I managed to turn it into reality.
Were there any parts of the reality? Obviously, it has changed over time with the change of technology and the change in the industry. But are there any parts of it as you became professional that were actually surprising to you that you didn't realize would be actually part of the process?
Well, I think your early dreams are very naive. You know, there is so much involved. There's the rehearsals, there's the songwriting, there's the production, there's the artwork, there's the music videos. Did I say travel? The travel can be very tiring. You often hear touring artists complaining about the travel. Wonderful if you can get to the sort of status of someone like Elton John or others and just have a private jet. I can imagine that makes it much more appealing, much more easy. The schedules were so intense when the Kajagoogoo song was number one. So we went from nothing to this. It's like a sort of tidal wave of craziness. And there were girl fans screaming. It was Beatlemania for about 6 months, really. And you'd arrive in Paris and you'd be driven to the hotel. Very quick change, off to the radio station, quick change, off to the TV performance, quick change, go and do some interviews, back to the hotel, wake up, back to the airport, and just do the same again, day after day after day. Because when you have a song like Too Shy, literally going to number one in every country, and this is before the internet, before Zoom, before, yeah. You know, you had to go to these countries and promote your song on the equivalent of British Top of the Pops. I mean, I was so excited initially. I'm a Sagittarian and I still like to travel, don't get me wrong. I think it's all about balance, isn't it? Mm. If you spend too much time doing one thing, the novelty wears off, as it were. But it was full of surprises. You really are thrown in at the deep end. And then really, when I look back, I think nobody really took me aside, either from my manager or from my record company, and gave me any guidance. They sat me down with a tabloid newspaper, very famous here in the UK, called The Sun.
Yes.
So I sat down with this journalist and I talked about a lot of things, you know, my music, just anything and everything about my life. And I very, very briefly mentioned that someone had given me a drug, a recreational drug, when I was in New York about the age of 19. And I didn't enjoy the experience. And I said something along the lines of, yeah, I felt that drugs could drive me crackers, you know, and I laughed about it. Guess what was the headline?
Oh, my word.
Drugs Drove Me Crackers by Lamal. And I just thought, the guy from EMI Records then, I think they've merged now with Warner, EMI Records, he should have warned me, you know. It's almost like they wanted it to happen. Bit of scandal can't hurt type of thing. So yeah, very much learning the craft as you go along, in at the deep end, mostly exciting, sometimes a bit scary.
You reference this sensationalism and what's now called clickbait, very much related to, in inverted commas, famous people. You know, that people want to hear the story and the juice and the drama. And unfortunately, human nature is linked to negativity, fear, and all things that are not very positive. So the minute it's something negative, like that headline, it's that, oh, we must dive into that instead of something that's positive. How have you observed this in your career? And what advice would you give to any other artists or people that are faced with these type of negativity aspects, you know, even if they're on social media being trolled?
Oh, I always think 50 years ahead. So in 50 years, I will not be here.
Yes.
And it won't mean anything. None of it means anything. You will be forgotten, because I love history and I've read about some amazing artists that performed in theatres in London. You know, when people reference theatre around the world, it's either Broadway or the West End.
Yes.
And here I am with the West End on my doorstep. And believe me, I have lapped it up over the years. I'm at the theatre this week. I was there 3 weeks ago. I'm going again in a couple of weeks to see something. And on my birthday, I'm going to see something else. And so I've delved into the history of theatre performance. And you have to remember how important they were socially and as sort of entertainment before cinema and perhaps even before radio. So we're talking late 1800s or slightly earlier into the early 1900s. And I read about performers that would pack a theatre that the newspapers would talk about. Let's go jump forward 100 years. No one really remembers. And so that's what I tell myself. I would say to up-and-coming artists, don't worry too much. It'll all be meaningless when, in 50 years. I mean, today, the value of stuff seems to have gone down. And I think they say the attention span of someone on social media is about 20 seconds. I think that says a lot. I was actually a target, if you like, of being used as clickbait. So I did an interview with a girl that does some social media stuff here. And just for fun, she said, why don't we just do something for social media? Why don't we lip sync the chorus of Too Shy? And I said, great, why don't we use hairbrushes? Because that's what you did as a kid. You got a hairbrush and you were in the mirror, miming to your favorite song. So, of course, being a girl, she had a hairbrush. I had a hairbrush with me because I was, I'd been doing some filming. So we both got the hairbrush and we're singing Too Shy. And it looked great. But of course, what I forgot was Hayley, that's her name. She's a really tall girl. And so she sat next to me and I looked like this sort of midget next to her. It was perfect. The national newspapers got on it and used it as clickbait. And within about 2 weeks, it had 500,000 views on TikTok.
But in what way, how did they create clickbait out of it? What was the sensational story?
The sensational story was, look what's happened to this 80s star now, kind of implying how terrible I look.
Oh, goodness.
Or what's become of me.
Yes.
And then there were some horrible comments. The guy looks ill, Oh, is he still alive? Yeah. Oh, I could go on. In the end, I just stopped reading them and I just thought, no, it's just keyboard terrorists out there, fodder for the, but for equally forgotten very quickly. That's how you deal with it. I mean, I've seen movie stars being interviewed who say, there's somebody very famous, who was it? But I've seen it a lot. They'll say one review of the film said that they were absolutely brilliant. And the next newspaper or reviewer said it was the film was awful and they were awful. So he said, so what I do is I don't read them because it's just one person's point of view.
Exactly. And everyone's got different tastes and different enjoyments and different passions. So I totally agree with that. Whenever there's new movies or theaters and stuff, I do not look at reviews because some of the, in inverted commas, worst movies ever released on cinema, according to critics, according to the box office, are in my top 10 of favorite movies. So there we go.
Yeah. I've been to see a show when it first came out, for example, first opened in the West End. And we've all loved it. And then I read a review in the next few days and I think, wow, did this person see the same show as me? So you're right. I mean, I think, we share information so much. It's so easy now to share information. And I think there was a time when a critic review could absolutely kill something, but I don't think that applies anymore.
That's true. You've been in the industry for a number of years, number of decades, still creating music, still performing. What is your motivation to keep getting up on stage, to keep creating?
Oh, it's lovely. It's lovely. You have to remember, when I perform, I take people back to a time of their lives when they bought my records. So we're going back 40 years. People say it was the first record they bought, or it reminds them of their first lover, or the first dance at a wedding, whatever it is. So there's this big wave of nostalgia. Nostalgia is actually a really powerful emotion, you know, and that's one thing that the new kids on the block will never, they've got to earn that, you know. That only comes with time. And so I see lots of people smiling, and I think it's always a challenge too. I mean, I've not sang for a few months, and I have a gig coming up in January. It's been quite nice. I always feel it's like a holiday for my vocal cord, because I have been singing a long time. And you hear of, we all know of artists who've had nodules on their vocal cords and had the operation, and it's changed the tone of their voice. All sorts of singers have had vocal problems. Touch wood, and I'm leaning over doing that right now. You know, I've not had any problems with my voice. And I was singing in the car today, just coming back from the gym. And I'm just thinking, oh, the tone is so nice. You know, I'm normally quite a self-deprecating person, but when I say that tone's quite nice, I was recognizing the fact that my voice had enjoyed the rest.
Ah.
You know, a break from singing. But it's always a challenge, you know, can you still do it? You can never sort of rest on your laurels. Every performance requires energy and requires preparation. Yeah, you've got to really be on it. And that includes a lot of things, you know. It's, you've got to be physically and mentally fit. The way I describe it is bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. That's how I've got to be. So it's all, that's always a challenge. And at 67 years old, coming up to, yeah, I don't feel 67, I have to say. Yeah, I'm so on rock and roll me. You know, I that's probably why the newspapers are not interested in me, because, you know, I'm not the party animal. I'm not, there's no scandal, touch wood. Again, no sex, drugs and rock and roll, you see. But I'm fine with that. I like the idea of longevity and I'm pleasing the audience. I'm kind of like now, like a, if you know, if you bought a vase, do you say vase or vase in South Africa?
A vase.
A vase. Okay. Yeah. In America, it's vase.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like a 1950s vase or something. I've got this retrospective value. I'm a bit of an antique. And actually, that's quite nice.
Well, you referenced earlier about the age of a number. Now, for me, I get frustrated because it's a number that does not exist. Obviously, there's attachments around years and stuff. But I find a lot of people in society, they say, oh, they now this age means they can't do this, or their body should be not be able to do that. I'm like, nonsense, because your body responds to what you say about it. So the more you say, okay, I can, I will, and I'm going to, and not I can't because of an obscure number that does not exist, the more your body will respond to that energized longevity that you reference to.
Yeah, and negative thoughts just breed more negative thoughts.
Exactly.
I mean, the mental attitude definitely affects the physical. I've learned that with exercise. I've actually experienced what the scientists talk about during exercise, and being a spin teacher yourself, you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, there comes that point where you feel the endorphin release.
Yes.
And then I just start smiling at everything. I start thinking silly thoughts and then chuckling. And the teacher might be looking at the back of the class thinking, Chris is having a mini high. Yeah, it's great.
You referenced that nostalgia is an amazing feeling, and you just answered a question for me that I've had, and I've spoken to lots of artists about, because there's a lot of these 80s and 90s rewind festivals, 2000s, where all these artists are coming together to perform and reignite those, that type of music or those songs. A lot of the artists were like, what is that touch? Why is it happening? And it's not only the older people. There are lots of younger kids at these shows. And you just gave me the nail on the head right now, the answer, which is nostalgia is a powerful feeling and an amazing feeling. So that's why these events and concerts and all the music from these generations are reignited.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. I think when you find young people at a sort of retro event, it's because the parents have been playing that music and you hear it. I know I experienced that growing up. In 2019, the Netflix series Stranger Things featured Never Ending Story. And I saw the online streams go up from 300,000 a month to nearly 2 million.
Wow.
Which is still currently at. And I think the kids were getting into the song, watching that TV show, and the parents were going, oh, we know this song. He loved this song. We were there the first time, you know. So you've got two generations there enjoying it. And possibly there'll be three soon, because Never Ending Story just seems to go on and on. There's a stage musical running in Spain. The author's family, Michael Ende, the German author, his family have just sold the book rights, or sold the story anyway, sold some rights to a very big production company who are commissioned to do a live action series.
Oh, wow.
Never Ending Story. So whether they use my song, even if it's re-recorded by some new artist, it will still have some spillover to the original version.
Yes, I love that.
So and the streams are like 200 million. And Too Shy with Kajagoogoo, yes, a worldwide number one as well. And that's only at 100 million all-time streams. That's on one of the platforms. Obviously, there are several other platforms. Mm. Yeah, Never Ending Story is the one. It's just, see, it just does something to people.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you to you guys for all the hard work in your creative process. I'm not sure if you are aware, you may or may not be, that there's a massive uptick of physical around the world. 2 years ago in the UK, 5.9 million vinyls sold, the biggest since 1990. Last year in the UK, there's a basket of products that they gauge exchanges on. And based on these exchanges, which there needs to be a large amount each day, they monitor it for some or other tax purposes. And because of the upsurge of CDs again, CDs are now back in the basket. And the research is showing it's the teenagers, it's the younger kids diving into this world, not necessarily the older, in inverted commas, nostalgic people. Then we have streaming platforms, as you referenced. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Well, for a long time, people have been complaining. Artists have been complaining about the royalty payments that they receive. This is a deal, the deals that were done with the four majors, Sony, Warner, Universal and BMG, who kind of swallowed up over the last 30 years. They swallowed up all the independent record companies. There were about 40 you could go to when we were looking for a record deal. This is globalization. This is what people were afraid of. You know, we had marches about that sort of stuff in this country. The conglomerates have done deals with the streaming platforms, and it's not that favorable to artists. I know there's been a campaign that included members of ABBA, Paul McCartney, and some other giants in the industry to try and get it changed. I know that in government, the culture secretary is also looking at this, so things may improve in time. The weird thing is, there is a benefit from being streamed, and I know it because I've experienced it myself. I've been in a store, for example, out and about in daily life. Here's something. In fact, it happened 3 days ago. I was in a store and I thought, oh, what is this? Hit the phone, hit this, is it called Shazam?
Yes.
Which is an amazing technology. Within about 5 seconds, it knew what this is. press another button and it links to Spotify. And that's happening with my music. I get reports from iTunes and it will say, you had 57,000 Shazams this month. One month it was nearly 100,000 Shazams. And that was probably related to the TV show that I referenced. So there is a benefit. I really genuinely believe there's a benefit of your music reaching a bigger audience, a much wider audience, because it's just so convenient. I'm old school. I remember when you used to go on holiday when we were young and you'd take your record collection and it was heavier than your suitcase.
Yes, yes.
You know, so having your phone with you with this and a Bluetooth speaker and access to every piece of music that you love almost, it is rather remarkable. So that's the plus of that.
Yes.
But the negative is some artists feel it's killing music sales, but you can't stop progress, you know. No, I don't think anyone envisaged how important mobile phones and internet technology would become. And it is what it is. It's there. It ain't going away. But it's very interesting. You see, here's the other potential benefit. If someone discovers you through Shazam and through popping up on a streaming platform, they might then go out and come to your concert. They might go to your online store and buy a t-shirt. They might buy your records. They might buy those CDs and vinyls that you referred to. So I think there's a place for the streaming sites. And of course, there'll never be anything more special than holding a piece of vinyl, you know, the smell of it, the holding it, putting it on the record player, either manually putting that arm across or just watching it. When I was a kid, I was fascinated with this jukebox in the cafe across the road. I was only about 8. And it was one of those where all the records were on this sort of turntable thing in the middle. And you put in like G7. You put your coin in G7 and this thing would go ticka 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 ticka. It would spin around and suddenly a mechanical arm would pick up the vinyl, flip it over onto the turntable, and the arm would come across. It's just pure magic.
Absolutely.
And I think there's still that. I mean, certainly for me, I think a 12-inch record or an album, you're looking at the artwork, aren't you? You're holding something visceral, you know. This is part of the enjoyment of being involved with that artist, I think. So, yeah, I'm generally feeling positive about it all.
A quick overview of your Christmas single that is coming out.
So it's been a lifelong challenge, really. And every year I would say, can't write a Christmas song. They've all been written. There's something about certain Christmas songs that come around. It's so warm and comforting, like an old friend. I love Christmas. I think it helps us get through winter in this country anyway.
Yes.
I know for you guys it's the opposite. Yeah, January, February, March is really boring because there's nothing happening and it's cold. So we can forget about winter in the lead up to Christmas and think about buying gifts and seeing family and just enjoying the Christmas music. I just wanted to be part of that, really. And then I met a piano player that does the Great American Songbook at the Savoy Hotel, John Nicol. And I thought, that's the kind of song I want to write. So let me sit down with John. It just so happened we were introduced, and he lived around the corner from me in North London at the time. So, yeah, one afternoon in June, we wrote a Christmas song. You know, to find a new angle into Christmas is very difficult. So, but when we basically took a modern idea, which is kind of, you know, you see it advertised now on websites, on travel websites, a city break. So here we have our couple going for a city break in London. Why not London? We've got all these songs about San Francisco and Chicago and New York, etc. Not that many about London. And I love London. I've lived here all my life. So as soon as we started thinking about London and about the city break, that gave us a new angle into Christmas.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.